I'll keep talking happy talk. Talk about things you'd like to.
This is Ann Corcoran on MattyRadio.com. Another one of my interviews with interesting people in Sarasota. My guest today, Sonia Pressman Fuentes, was born in Berlin, Germany, came to the U.S. as a child with her family to escape the Holocaust, and has written a book of memoirs that, among other things, reveals how this five-year-old immigrant in 1934 grew up to become the first woman attorney in the Office of the General Counsel at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, known as EEOC, and a staunch supporter of women's rights. During our talk today, Sonia no doubt will inform us of her involvement in the formation of the National Organization for Women in 1966. In her book, Eat First, You Don't Know What They'll Give You, Sonia's stories of her parents' life before she arrived on the scene, her childhood, and her road to success may delight, sadden, and sometimes anger you, but it will always keep you engaged. Sonia, welcome to the program today.
Thank you, Anne. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon.
How did this book get started? This isn't the book you had in mind when you decided you were going to write a book, is it?
No, it isn't. I originally planned to write a totally different book. I retired from my work as an attorney with the federal government in 1993. And for about a year, I floundered around not knowing what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And then the idea occurred to me, which a number of people had told me during my life, to write a book. But the book that I planned to write was a history of the second wave of the women's movement and my involvement in it. I knew I had had the opportunity to play a historic role in the second wave, and I thought I had a responsibility to write it down. But I didn't want to do all the work myself. I had a huge amount of files in my basement dealing with my activities since 1966, 65. I didn't want to wade through them all myself. So I was looking for a writer who would work with me. And that took a great deal of time, I think almost a year or so, and didn't really accomplish anything. Because I found that a writer will work with someone who isn't a celebrity only upon the payment of a great deal of money. So a friend of mine then suggested that I go to the Foundation Center Library in Washington, D.C. That's a library having to do with grants and grant making. And she suggested I go down there and to see if I couldn't apply for a grant, which would give me the money to hire a writer so I could do on the second wave.
And then the world of grant writing. You get led to that whole thing about grant writing. You must have fallen into some abyss and not known what to do after you got in there.
Well, what happened was, on my way to the Foundation Center Library, while I was still at home, I took a look at myself in the mirror, and I did something that I very rarely do. I had a conversation with God. And I said, God, if you want this book to be written, you'll have to make it happen because I've done everything I can do. I'm going to this Foundation Center Library, but that's the last thing I'm going to do. If it doesn't work, that's it. Having said that to God, I took off for the Foundation Center Library. And when I got there, there were lots of pamphlets and brochures and books about applying for grants, but those were mostly, I felt, for organizations and companies that were in the business of writing grants. It's a very specialized field. And I realized in short order that I wouldn't be able to do that myself unless I read a lot of books, took training programs, and I was not about to do that.
Well, that's what I meant about falling into this abyss, because that grant writing is a whole world unto itself, and that would have taken up the time that you were going to use to write the book.
Absolutely. So mixed in with all the brochures on grant seeking was a business from a woman, and her name was Sue Fisher, and she hired herself as a writer and an editor. So I picked up that card and decided to call her. So I went home, and I'm sorry, her name is Sarah Fisher, not Sue Fisher. I went home and I called her and I told her that I was looking for a writer to work with me. And she said that she's an editor and a writer, but that she does fiction. And I told her, well, I do nonfiction. And I was about to end the conversation. She said, no, we can meet. So we arranged to meet, and we did meet in a restaurant called Zorba's Cafe in DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C. And we began to chat, and she told me that she was the editor of a newspaper for a Catholic organization, and she was also a tour guide, and she went on chatting, and I realized that this woman and I had absolutely nothing in common. So I said to her, well, I see that we have nothing in common. And I wanted to end the conversation. She paid absolutely no attention to me, went right on talking, and then she said something that changed my life. And what she said was, that isn't the book you want to write. With regard to...
Yes, so she was really a good listener. She was hearing things that you were saying that you didn't even realize you were telling her.
Absolutely. And I said to her, it isn't? And she said, no, she said, you want to write a book of stories like you've been me this afternoon, the kind of stories you like to tell about yourself and your parents. She says, you need to go home and write that book yourself. So I went home and wrote that book myself.
Well, Sonia, in the book, Eat First, You Don't Know What They'll Give You, you take these stories and you give us a basis to begin with, and then you weave these stories throughout the book with your involvement in the women's movement or your involvement, well, your marriage or your daughter, so that these stories get us started. Then sometimes you get a little and jump back, and sometimes you're here and there, and each time it seems to remind you of a story, and then you give us the story, which is fun. It's a fun way to read this book. Now, I don't really feel that we can do some of the stories justice on the air in short order, but there are some of the stories that might be able to relate to people that the book can be fun as well as serious. And that's something interesting in this book that you've written, the serious stuff about your involvement with the women's movement, but the fun stuff about how you got there, and maybe even encouragement to young people who flounder a while before they decide what they want to do with their lives. Let's talk a little bit about that, how long it took you, and how many jobs you went through, and how many businesses you put out of business.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you said it might be an inspiration to young people, because all my life I've been intimidated, when I was younger, really, by young people who are 14 or 15 or 18 or 22, and they know exactly what they want to do with their lives. And I used to hear people like that, and I would just be awed, because I never knew what I wanted to do with my life. And I was very impressed with such people. On the other hand, as I've had occasion to age and see what happens to some of these people, some of them indeed do what they plan to do, and a lot of them don't. So I've always been a supporter of people who don't know what they want to do and sort of go by trial and error and fumble along, which is just what I did, and seem to do all right too.
Well, and another thing, at the time that you were trying to decide what to do with your life, women's lives were pretty well planned. Women didn't get careers. Women didn't go off to college in the same rates, of course, that they do today. And most families were preparing their women for homemakers and mothers and to be married. And that just was something that you seem not to have any interest in right from the beginning.
Well, I think that's kind of true. I certainly was greatly encouraged by my family, my parents, and my brother to get married at 18, have a family, and not think of anything else. I didn't do that for two reasons. The first was that I was not a raving beauty, and nobody was coming after me whom I had any interest in at 18 or thereafter to marry. So that option was basically not open to me. Secondly, I did all right in math, and I figured out that if I were 18 and got married and had children, let's say my kids would be grown when I was 36, what would I do the rest of my life? And I go around asking people that question, and I never really got a decent response. So it occurred to me that that is not enough, because we can live to 65 or 75 or whatever. So I was interested in doing something else that would have longer range possibilities. And there was an additional factor for me. As you mentioned, I was a survivor. Well, not a survivor. I, I was a survivor in the sense that I got out of Germany.
Yes, I was going to go back to that very soon, that your family left Germany because of the Nazis and what the changes that were taking place in Europe. And you just barely got out in time.
We got out very early in 1933, but that had a tremendous impact on my life. That was one of three things that had a big impact on my life. One was that my life had been saved from the Holocaust. Secondly, and I tell the story in my book, my mother had had a number of abortions before I was born because it was not fashionable for well-to-do people in Germany to have a lot of children. And she went to have an abortion with me, and because the doctor was out of town, she didn't have it. That was the second factor in my life, where my life had been saved. And third, I had always done well in school, and I knew I was bright. And I thought those three things meant that I was not free to just get married and have a family like other people did. I felt that my life had been saved, and that it was saved for a purpose, and that there was something I needed to do with that life. I had no idea what it was, but I had that feeling from the time I was 10 years old.
Now, you mentioned recently, you just mentioned that your mother had had several abortions and that you would have been scheduled for one. But you are a pro-choice feminist, are
Absolutely.
You not? Okay. So that comment about having had your life saved just meant that you felt you personally needed to go on and do something and to justify that in a way.
Right. But I'm certainly pro-choice.
Yeah.
I am somebody, as I'm sure many people are, that I'm grateful that I was never in a situation where I had to have an abortion. I don't think an abortion is a happy thing. But if a woman decides that she's in a situation where she needs an abortion, I certainly wanted to have that option.
Now, I wanted to bring up something else about your mother when we were talking about education and going to school. Your mother was very interested in education and was herself well-educated for her time. And went to night school and things after she got to this country. I mean, she didn't have what we might call a formal education in some sense today, or she had a limited formal education, but education was important to her.
You're right. My mother loved education. She loved learning. She loved English. She had barely any formal education. I think she just went to a few grades in Poland because she had uncles who were teachers. But that was the extent of her formal education. But she spoke a wonderful Polish. She knew German, fairly good English, Yiddish, knew a little bit of Russian, and she was a proponent of education. Not for me. She wasn't a proponent of advanced education for women, but she did enjoy learning very much.
And yet your parents supported you in your choices and decisions to go on to school, to go to college. They seemed to support those decisions and help you in every way they could for you to accomplish those goals.
They supported me financially, and also when I went to law school, they moved to provide a place where I could live while I went to law school. In those senses, they supported me. They did not support me in that they encouraged what I was doing. They were very unhappy with what I was doing, but they were so incredible that because of their tremendous love for me, even though they totally opposed what I was doing, they turned their lives around to facilitate my doing it.
Now, after you finished college, this gets us back to young people not always knowing what to do with their lives. When you finished with college, you had a hard time finding work that was equal to the education and knowledge that you now had. You would go for job interviews where you were looking for a job and they would offer you a secretarial job or something, even after you went to law school.
That is true. We'll start with college. When I got out of college, I was the first member of my family who had been to college and probably high school too. And I thought, and I was Phi Beta, I'd gone to Cornell, so I thought, my God, when I get out of college, they'll be breaking down the door, offering me jobs. Nobody offered me jobs. And I went out looking for jobs, and I had several jobs, none of which amounted to anything. And I couldn't really get a decent job until I went to shorthand, to business school. I'd already had typing in high school, and then I studied shorthand. And I finished shorthand school on a Friday, and on Monday I had a job. And that shows what they valued women for. This is in the 1990s, what they were looking for in women. I got jobs as a secretary. And I did that on and off for 4 years. And then, as you mentioned, then I went to law school. I graduated first in my class. And I got a job with the federal government, which was hiring women. But after I was working for the federal government, I was looking to get into private practice. And you're right, I was offered jobs as a receptionist, or I was not offered jobs. I was told they didn't have a restroom for women. I was told I couldn't work there because sometimes the men might swear. I was asked how come I could assure them that I wouldn't get pregnant. This was at a time that I wasn't even dating anybody. So you're absolutely right. It was tough for women to get professional jobs.
This is Ann Corcoran on MattyRadio.com. I'm talking with Sonia Pressman Fuentes, author of Eat First, You Don't Know What They'll Give You. We'll be right back.
Fumi's Ocean Dream, 1359 and a half Main Street, downtown Sarasota. Sushi at its best, a restaurant showcasing entertainment from jazz to belly dancing. Lunch and dinner specials featured daily. A great gathering place where the food is delicious and fun is served free of charge. Go to Tokyo without leaving the States. Fumi's Ocean Dream, Japanese seafood cuisine and sushi bar. 1359 and a half Main Street in the heart of downtown Sarasota.
With Famous Women in History, this is Ann Corcoran on MattyRadio.com. Known as the Moses of her people, this African-American woman was born into slavery on a farm in Dorchester County, Maryland. Determined to be free, she knew others had managed to escape, and following the North Star, she made her way to freedom. As a conductor on the Underground Railroad, she returned to the South 19 times, leading over 300 people to freedom, without losing one life in the process. Between trips, she earned her living as a cook in a boarding house in Canada. During the Civil War, she served 3 years as a nurse, spy, and scout for the Union Army. After the war, she founded two schools, worked for women's suffrage, and opened a home for the aged. She was Harriet Tubman. And this is Ann Corcoran for Famous Women in History on MattyRadio.com.
Hi, I am Fernando Gomez. Please join me on Wednesday afternoon, 3 to 5 o'clock, for Spanish music, information, and news. Recuerde, los miércoles de 3 a 5 de la tarde, on MattyRadio.com.
And this is Ann Corcoran on MattyRadio.com. I'm talking with Sonia Pressman Fuentes, author of Eat First, You Don't Know What They'll Give You. Sonia, we were just talking before we went to commercial about the kinds of jobs that you were offered or the questions that people asked you before they would even considering you, questions that couldn't possibly be asked today without somebody bringing a lawsuit, and yet you ended up in the EEOC, Equal Opportunity Employment Commission, working to formulate and work with some of the very first laws enacted so that women could participate in other jobs and get equal treatment. And even that was, by some people, an accident that that clause was added to the title. Was that Title VII?
Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Mm-hmm. So you were involved in that act right from the beginning.
That I came aboard 3 months after the agency opened for business. The agency opened for business July 2nd, 1965, and I joined October 4th, 1965.
And you were one of the few people that advocated the civil rights for women as well as blacks, as this Title VII was really created for.
That's true. I was one of the few women, one of the few people at the agency, although there were others. Mm-hmm. But when I joined it, there were about 100 permanent employees at the agency. Most of them had come there to fight discrimination against African Americans. And most of them did not want the agency's time and staff and money to be diverted to issues of sex discrimination.
Mm-hmm. And the way that got added from Congress was kind of a fluke. It was just something somebody put in. And one of the congressmen put in and didn't even probably think through the impact that that might have.
That's not strictly true, but mm-hmm. It's the popular myth.
Oh, okay.
It's a little more complicated than that. The Equal Pay Bill had been introduced, I think, for 23 years before it was finally passed in 1964. it prohibited discrimination based on sex and wages and salaries. So that was passed a year before. Then when they were debating Title VII in the Congress, initially it did not include sex. That is correct. It just prohibited employment discrimination based on race, color, religion, and national origin. Now, Martha Griffiths, a wonderful congresswoman, told me that if Howard Smith of Virginia hadn't introduced the amendment to prohibit sex discrimination, she would have. But be that as it may, it hadn't been introduced when Howard Smith, a segregationist from Virginia, introduced an amendment to add sex discrimination. His motives are not clear. On the one hand, he was an opponent of the entire civil rights bill and was not interested in its being passed. And he may have thought that by adding this amendment, he would stop passage of the entire bill or forestall its passage, delay it. On the other hand, he was not interested in African Americans getting rights ahead of white women. And so he had that other goal, and whether they were both working in him or only one was working, we don't really know. But he did introduce the amendment, although he certainly didn't favor it.
That is kind of an interesting history to that. And that was one of the things that was part of implementing Title VII, is to get a little bit of the congressional history and what the Congress was debating and discussing and thinking when they were deciding whether or not to pass Title VII. And so, again, understanding the history can be important as well. Now, I want to look at a little bit of the history, again, of you and your family, because you have some funny stories in this book, and we're talking about the Equal Employment Commission and about you going to school and about some of the problems that you faced and that women in general faced. But when you weave these other stories of your family in there, I think people get a whole picture of what may have caused you to be told that you couldn't have an apartment one time, and not because you were Jewish, and not because your husband was Hispanic, but because you were uppity. Have you been called uppity more than once, Sonia?
Not to my face.
But there you were, doing all these battles, and therefore some people might have thought that of you.
Well, I consider that a compliment.
Well, just tell us that story about the apartment, if you would, please.
Well, there were a couple of stories in my book about the apartment. About getting an apartment. I'll try to think of the one that you mentioned. I was engaged, and my fiancé and I were looking for an apartment in Virginia. And we looked at this one apartment that we both liked very much, and I happened to fill out the application. Oh, I think this is another story.
That's a good story, too.
I'll tell this one. I happened to fill out the application, and a day or so later, I got a call from the manager of the apartment building saying that she needed my fiancé's signature, too. I thought nothing of it, and he came over that night. But he had become more sensitive to women's rights than I had. And he said to me, "Why do they need my signature? They've got yours." So I said, "You know, you've got a point there." And the next day I called the manager and I said, "You asked for my fiancé's signature. If he had filled out the application, would you have asked for mine?" And she said, "Yes." Well, that sounded all right. And then I spoke with her a little bit more and told her that I been working for 16 years and I made a good living and I filled out the application. I didn't know why she needed his signature. And then she got upset and she began to scream at me. And she said, "I don't care if you make more money than he does. He's still the head of your household." So I calmly explained to her that in our proposed marriage, we did not expect a single head of a household, that we both planned to be the heads of the household. She didn't buy that, and we didn't get that apartment.
And that's not the first time that you didn't get an apartment, because you questioned them and then sometimes challenged them. And that was the second one that I was referring to, was the story where they denied you, and when you went to find out why, it was because you were uppity.
Right.
Well, don't we have that saying, uppity women don't get the blues, or something like that?
Somebody wrote me something the other day about uppity women rule the world, I think.
Well, it could be worse. I mean, it could be worse than having Sonia Pressman Fuentes ruling the world. Because after all, if, with your work at EEOC, I'm sure you would be pretty fair.
Well, I'd like to think I would be fair, but I do not think I'm in any position to rule the world.
No, I don't really think so either. I was just kidding as well. Sonia, I just wanted to mention a little bit more regarding your retirement. And that was what you mentioned, that when you first retired, after all of the important, challenging, high-powered jobs you had, you also worked with TRW in a very important position there. And was it GTE?
GTE.
Mm-hmm. And so you've had a lot of a very active, successful career, and then you faced retirement, and you decided to write this book. But that put you another entire path, so that you found out that there's another new life out there for Sonia Pressman Fuentes, right?
Well, that's been a very exciting thing that happened to me. Yes, I decided to write the book. It took me 5.5 years of researching, writing, editing, marketing, publishing the book. Fortunately, I did not know when I got into it what it would involve, which is true of many things we do. If we knew what they would entail, we probably would never do them. And during that whole time, until I started to get individual stories published, I really had no idea what I was doing. I was sitting home working at the computer all day long. My friends were out traveling, taking courses, going to Florida, going around the world. And I was sitting there working at the computer. I had no idea whether I really could write, whether I could write funny, which is how I do a lot of my writing. I had to unlearn legal writing. When I first wrote this book, I had over 100 footnotes.
Sounds like a lawyer to me.
Because that's the way I wrote, and then yes. I had to go back and rewrite for laypersons. So I had no idea that this would ever see the light of day, although it was always my intention to get it published. I wasn't one of these people who was writing for my children. I was writing for the general public, but I never knew whether it would see the light of day. And what happened was that it opened up a whole new world for me, the most exciting part of my life, where I've now become a writer and a public speaker.
Yes, and the stories in your book lend themselves to speaking or writing an article to each story or each chapter as well. Now, just before we close, I want to say you mentioned the research, and your book starts with your parents in a shtetl.
Shtetl is perfect.
Okay, in a shtetl in Poland, and then it takes you through all of that, interspersed back and forth sometimes with stories more contemporary of what was happening with you in the United States. The way you wove it together is very fun, interesting, but as I said, sometimes will make you sad and angry. So it was, I think you accomplished your goal in writing funny sometimes too.
Thank you.
Okay. And now tell people how they can get your book and then give your website.
Well, I'll start with my website so I don't forget it. It's http://www.erraticimpact.com/ www.erraticimpact, erraticimpact.com/Fuentes, which is spelled F as in Frank, U-E-N-T-E-S.
Before you tell them how they can find the book, I have to say, when I saw your website, I mean, I first went on and tried Sonia Pressman Fuentes and, of course, didn't find it. And when I figured out your website from some of the literature, I said, of course, who else would do that? Everybody else puts their name on their website, not Sonia.
Well, I'm not responsible for that.
Oh, okay.
I wrote to somebody several years ago that a friend told me about who had a philosophy website with a section on the philosophy of feminism. And so I wrote to him telling him I was a feminist. And I got an immediate email letter back saying he wants to create a website for me and maintain it. His website is erraticimpact.com, which is why I have that. And this wonderful agent, this wonderful angel, his name is Dan Polk, created this website overnight for me and has been maintaining it ever since.
Okay, now we'll just tell people how they can find your book.
One way to find the book is to go to a bookstore and see if the bookstore carries it, and if not, to ask the bookstore to order it. The book is called Eat First. You don't know what they'll give you. The Adventures of an Immigrant Family and Their Feminist Daughter. Or you can go to the website of my publisher, exlibris.com, xlibris.com, or you can get it from .com.
Quite a few ways to get it. And if they go to their website, if they forget any of that and go to your website, they'll find the way to get to it.
Thank you. And at the bottom of my website, it tells all the various ways in which you can order the book. It is even available as an ebook.
Okay, great. Thank you again, Sonia Pressman Fuentes, author of Eat First, You Don't Know What They'll Give You. And thank you for the interview. And it was nice talking with you today.
A pleasure to talk with you, Anne.